Welcome, baseball friends, to episode 32 of the Nats GM Show, the only podcast available via the Nats GM Radio Network. I am your host, Ryan Sullivan, editor-in-chief of NatsGM.com and the baron of all baseball podcasts. Before we are joined by this week's guest, I would like to briefly mention our sponsor, Amazon.com. If you want to help support this podcast, go to NatsGM.com, click on the Amazon link on the right side of the page, and do your online shopping. One more favor, if I might. Please rate and review this podcast on iTunes, as this helps us gain additional listeners to the show.
This is Matt from MattsBats.com, and you're listening to the Nats GM Show.
And now, without further ado, my guest this week is Grant Paulson. Many will know Grant from his many years in the Washington, D.C. media and his numerous appearances on the David Letterman Show. Now Grant is hosting the midday show on 106.7 The Fan with his tag team partner Danny Ruelier. The host of many baseball shows and a legend in local media, I am excited to have Grant on the show today. Grant, welcome to the Nats GM Show.
My pleasure. Thank you very much. Looking forward to chatting.
Well, first and foremost, I want to thank you first for coming on the show, and I just want to say I'm a big fan of your work. I know I'm a few years older than you, but like I said to you off air, I feel like I've kind of grown up with you in certain ways, so it's a real treat to talk to you today. Thank you.
That means a lot. I appreciate that, and that's one of the real flattering, cool things occasionally is that someone will say, I remember when you were doing this years ago. I remember when I saw you as a kid. And that goes back now to 1999 when I was 10 years old and I'm 26, so that's a huge chunk of my life that I've been able to spend off and on, obviously, with some hiatuses, but doing some pretty cool things in the sports broadcasting media. So it's always neat when somebody remembers anything because obviously that means, you know, they thought something of it to store it away, so that means a lot. Thanks.
Yeah, it was very cool. We always knew around Super Bowl time you were going to be doing something cool, so it was almost, okay, I've got to watch Letterman this week because I don't know where he's going to be or what he's going to be doing, but I know he's going to be tripping somebody up, so.
It was a really, really fun time. I mean, that to me was my most fun experiences when I look back. Some of the memories that I've timed to grow up are, you know, those Super Bowl trips, whether it was for Letterman doing some of the wacky gimmicks that they would draw up and their comedy writers would come together in a boardroom and put together for me, or even, you know, more serious stuff when I was with ABC Sports a couple years later and doing some things for their pregame show or interviewing players, whether it was in San Diego Qualcomm Stadium for the Raiders and the Bucks or any of the other Super Bowls. That's some of the, I think, culminating moments still today of what I've been able to do and some of my favorite memories for sure, because at that time I was so young I couldn't go there on my own. I couldn't drive, obviously, because they were no faraway trips, and I wasn't going to fly out of the city, you know, without any kind of supervision. So my parents would go with me and one or the other, and it was just kind of a really neat experience for me as a kid to be with your parent at an event like Super Bowl. It's just a cool way to grow up.
Well, I think a lot of people think that you got your start on Letterman, but you were doing stuff before then. So can you fill in kind of those of us who, I mean, we feel like we know you personally just from hearing you all these years, but kind of where did you get your start in media?
Yeah, I mean, it's really a lot of lucky coincidences kind of leading to this chain reaction of sorts. But basically the way it all started was I was a diehard sports fan as a kid. Like a lot of kids, I think I would watch every single game. Unlike most kids, I would say, I really didn't have other interests in the sense that I wasn't really watching cartoons. I can't remember ever watching a Saturday morning cartoon, or I wasn't reading comic books or anything like that. I mean, I was just watching and playing sports. That's really all I cared about. That was my passion. That was my entire life. And you know, initially I would watch the games like anyone else, and then I would start to be enamored with and study the players, and I really started to study statistics, memorize stats. I was fascinated by them. And then I would study all the rosters, and I would know the names and numbers of the players, and I would try to study where they came from, what college, what other teams they played for. And so from a really young age, I was always kind of enthralled with the broadcasting element of the game, because that's the best way to learn that information. At that time, I'm not jumping on the internet. So the play-by-play or the color guy was giving you a lot of that info, so I would kind of listen really intently to what they were saying. And I had guys I liked and guys I didn't like calling games. And this was all as a child. You know, I would be in car rides on long trips with my dad and my siblings, and I would you know, put together like steak Orioles keys to the game brought to you by some car dealership, and I would just talk about, you know, we'll stay low in the zone and get ahead of hitters and basic things like that, you know, that you heard on some of the broadcasts and stuff. That started at a very young age. Then I was lucky enough at about 10 years old to start to get some opportunities where my uncle was a radio personality in Pittsburgh, and I didn't think much or know a whole lot about the radio at that time, but he had me call into his show to do football picks because of a bet we'd made at a family picnic about a Redskins-Steelers preseason scrimmage. Not even a game, but like a scrimmage they used to hold where they would get together before the exhibition season.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember watching one of those, and like months after the fact, I was talking trash to my uncle from Pittsburgh about how the Redskins had beaten them in some scrimmage 10-7, and I was recalling a bunch of statistics, and he was just thought it was the most ridiculous thing ever. But he also, in his mind, as a morning drive DJ, was thinking probably, you know, this is hilarious and people will get a big kick out of this. So he had me call into his show one time, and I remember thinking it was a one-and-done kind of deal. I remember putting a recorder up to the phone, trying to record the conversation, and obviously that didn't work. But
right.
I ended up calling into his show every week for, you know, throughout the football season to make football picks 4 or 5 games a week. They would keep a running tally, and it, you know, he would call me his 10-year-old bookie and things like that. So I was doing that, and the local newspaper wrote a story about that. And at that point, they asked me after they got a nice response, and this is a tiny county that I lived in, you know, once a week newspaper that mostly wrote about those school board activities or what had events going on. They asked me to author like a 100-word column every week that I would email them on the sports world, the Wizards, the Caps, whatever. So I started doing that, and this is about in fifth grade. Channel 9 in the Washington found out about this and wanted to do a story about it. So they came to my house and sent a cameraman and a couple producers. So they filmed at my house, you know, me kind of talking about sports and writing one of the columns. They went to school that day, followed me all over the place. So that story got a really good response. It aired one afternoon in Sweeps on Channel 9. And so then they asked me to start coming up on Fridays during the football season to make picks.
And this is where I became familiar with you, absolutely.
Okay, yeah, so I think this is where a lot of people probably, like, for the first time, because otherwise it was very localized, you know, either Pittsburgh-based or, you know, in King George County, my hometown. And so people started seeing me on Channel 9, I guess, which is where I was doing the football pick. They took me to training camp. They took me to Oriole Park, to Camden Yards for opening day to interview Cal Ripken. Took me to some Wizards games in the locker room. That was a really big breakthrough because I was actually going to the games. They'd have to preface it with the PR staff and warn the players, and the players all really got a huge kick out of it and seemingly liked to do it. Well, obviously, CBS is an affiliate with The Late Show, so someone at Letterman got wind of this or saw me, I guess, on one of those appearances. And at that point, that's when I went on Letterman, and that was a huge kind of differentiating break in the sense that other shows like Real Sports with Brian Gumbel and shows like that did some features. Magazines like Sports Illustrated and SI for Kids did write-ups. And that eventually would lead on to some of the ABC Sports gigs, Little League World Series and otherwise. And just some of the really cool, very fun, very lucky, amazing experiences I got to have. And I ended up getting to go on Letterman 6 times. I actually went up there 7 times and got bumped. The one time I got bumped is probably the best story of any of my experiences up there, and is my favorite time I ever went up there, which is funny. But it's just really neat, and that's kind of, to get you up to speed of, like, everyone thinks the Letterman thing was big anyway, that's kind of what led up to it, I guess.
Okay, well then now I have to ask the question, what happened when you got bumped on Letterman?
Yeah, so, I'm glad you did, actually. So I went up there, it's an ultimate trip I made to the Ed Sullivan Theater. So this was probably when I was like 17, I think I was just about to enter my senior year of high school. The first time I was on was when I was 11, if the math's right, I believe it was 7th grade. And the last time I went up there was right before my senior year of high school. That summer, I went up to the theater, and the way that it would work, basically, and the way that I went on so many times, was that I was basically like a fill-in of sorts, where someone would cancel, they'd feel like they needed to bring somebody up, they'd call me last minute, you know, 10 o'clock the night before, they'd take at 5:30 or whatever. Can you get up here by tomorrow? I'd obviously say yes. And then they'd have me up there to talk about sports. Well, on this particular time, they called it like noon. And I live, obviously, in Virginia. The show takes a little bit after 5. but can you get to the airport by 2 and get to the theater by 5? We'll have a limo and all that stuff waiting. And I'm like, I don't know. So my dad comes home from work. We get right to the airport. You know, we're flying. We make record time up to Dallas, I think it was. We fly out with one of those, like, charters that happens every half hour, you know, the LaGuardia. So we land. We're rushing to the Ed Sullivan Theater. We get there, like, right at 5 o'clock through all the New York traffic and everything. And so we're there for the taping that starts in a half hour. And I'm going upstairs to my dressing room. And they always gave me a dressing room, which I always found hilarious. It was like, have your name on it, you know, and then you go in and they have all the sandwiches from Rupert's Deli and they have trays of cookies and sweets and there's all kinds of amazing things. And I just always thought it was so hilarious that, like, next door is LL Cool J or you know, Julian Moore or, you know, Kristen Davis, and I have the similar dressing room. It was just so dumb to me. But I always thought it was hysterical. So anyway, so I go up to what is supposed to be my dressing room, and I go in, and as I'm sitting in there, you know, there's a bunch of familiar faces, and I can't really place who's who, but I'm, like, thinking as I'm staring at these guys, I know these guys walk around in the hallway. You know, one by one, they'd come by every few minutes. Well, at one point, a guy walked in and asked to use the couch in the dressing room. He said, can you mind if I sit here and fill out this paper? I said, no, go ahead. Well, it was Brooks Robinson of the Baltimore Orioles, legendary icon.
You've got to be in heaven. Oh, wow.
Oh, I mean, I'm an Orioles fan, obviously. He's one of my dad's favorite players ever. Now, my dad is honestly not a big sports fan, which is kind of funny. Everyone always assumes, like, he was the driving force behind my, you know, being able to fall in love with sports and all those things. And he was incredible, like my mom was, in supporting me. And he was great in helping me to get opportunities and spreading the word and things like that. But he really wasn't a big sports fan. He was doing it like a dad was, you know, if I was a dancer or a singer or whatever, he would help me out in that way. But he is actually a longtime Brooks Robinson fan. His dad liked him and vice versa. So he right away said, oh, Brooks, what's going on? So we're sitting there talking to Brooks Robinson, and he's just very pleasant and filling out his paperwork to go on the show. And I'm like, wow, you're a guest on the show, too. He said, yeah, there's 10 of us here from the Hall of Fame because the inductions were the next week. Mm. And Gary Carter that year was getting in. He said, you know, Gary's here, and 10 of us from the Hall of Fame are doing the top 10 list tonight for perks of being in the Major League Baseball Hall of Fame. So Carter's sitting there, Brooks is sitting there telling us, he calls in Gary Carter, who's sitting there talking to us, and he says, you mind if the other guys come in? I said, no.
Yeah, so bring them in. Pick them up.
The Hall of Famers. So we're talking about Ozzie Smith, who I recognize right away. Raleigh Fingers was there with his crazy mustache. Bob Feller, who, of course, is, you know, one of the first flamethrowers in his era, and participated in a war. Van Meter, Iowa native. I mean, this is just an icon in the sport. But you go through the list, and it's guys like Bob Gibson, who are just like these baseball cards, and these baseball reference pages are coming to life in front of my eyes. But there are 10 of the games, greatest ever. Ralph Kiner was there, I remember off the top of my head. But they're all sitting on these chairs and couches now telling stories in my dressing room because they don't have anywhere to go. They're all wandering around the hallway. So these guys were so funny, and I just had so much fun talking to them. I ended up bonding with a few of them and keeping in touch for a little while, but they ended up taking so long on the top 10 because Letterman is a huge sports fan. He really is. And that's actually why I think I went up there so often, is because he just loved doing sports segments, and I was one of the guys in the rotation for him. But he had so much fun talking to these players that what should have been a 3-minute segment or whatever for the top 10 probably took 8 or 9. So they ran so late, I ended up being bumped. So they come to the dressing room. They're like, look, this never happens. We're really sorry about this. Especially because we called you, 4 hours ago to get up here. But we're running out of time. You're not going to be on the show tonight. We're booked up, you know, tomorrow and the next day, so we're not going to be able to put you on. I'm like, no worries. You know, this was great. I got to meet these guys. You know, it was awesome. They said, well, when this happens, we'd like to take care of our guests. You know, anything you want to do in the city, we have access to whatever you want to do, any kind of show or dinner, you just tell us, and we'll get you there tonight. And so I'm sure my dad was thinking about, like, the producers and some nice dinner, you know what I mean? And
so right, exactly.
Right away,
sure.
I said, well, you know, the Orioles are at Yankee Stadium tonight. And he goes, oh, really? He's like, we can get you some good seats for that game. I said, yeah, let's do it. So they got us tickets to the O's and the Yankees, sat behind home plate in the Lowe's, like, one section up. And the funny part about that was, Gary Carter was going to the game, so me and my dad and he and I believe his daughter rode over to the game together. We sat with Gary Carter at Yankee Stadium watching the whole game. Kind of just talked to him all night. So it was pretty incredible.
That's amazing. What is Gary like? Because I just had Jonah Carey on the podcast the other week, and he was telling Gary stories as well. What was Gary like?
Very cool guy. Very, very nice. You know, he was a storyteller from what I remember, too, because, you know, a lot of guys, especially if you're a young kid, and that's at the time, I mean, I was a high schooler, as I said, and I knew who Gary Carter was. I study baseball, and I study the sport, so I can tell you what teams he played for, you know, what his calling cards were, what the big moments of his career that people care about are. But, I mean, I was asking some questions just in general about his career and his teammates, and he was just very accommodating, very gracious, but also just a very down-to-earth guy. And one of the things I remember that was weird to me was, like, at Yankee Stadium that night, for the most part, when we were around, he was not being, like, recognized, or people weren't coming up to him. He was just one of the guys cheering at the game. But he was, my memories of him will just be that, hey, he couldn't have been more pleasant. And just as an example, I mean, they're getting a limo for us to go over to the game, and he's like, well, don't get another one, just jump in with us. I mean, this is me and my dad. He didn't know us at all, so I just will always remember how pleasant he was that night.
That's a great story, Grant. Final question on that story, though. So did you get a baseball signed by the guys?
I did not, and this is disappointing. Now, I will say I'm not really an autograph guy at this point in my life, only because I've never been allowed to ask for them.
And that's,
so if you think about it, you know, I'm 10 and credentialed at one point in time, and so that's like prime time go get autographs, real estate for a life, right? Like that 10 to 18 range or whatever. And I wasn't allowed to do it, even though I had all this access to these players. So it's just never been important to me. I love pictures. What I would kill for is a picture of me with those guys in my dressing room. And it sounds dumb, but I'll bet you there weren't even like camera phones at that point on cell phones. I guarantee there weren't.
Oh, definitely.
But today, if that happened, yeah. So if that happened today, when was that? 2004 or whatever it was, 2005? I don't know what year he got in. I bet you it was like the summer of 05 or something like that. But if that happened today, then I'm just getting a picture and it's the coolest thing ever. I didn't have anything like that. But I did ask. I remember specifically a couple times I would grab one of the guys from the Late Show, one of the runners or interns running around, and I'd say, hey, someone's got to have a baseball up there. And I remember distinctly saying, I need to get a baseball signed by all these guys. Nobody had a baseball anywhere. So it's just that we didn't have it, because that time I definitely would have asked. Because I wasn't at a game and I wasn't using a credential. I was just out and about.
Yeah, that's... Well, you'll always have that memory, but that would be great to have a little memento of something, a baseball or something from those guys.
Yeah. I think it's my favorite story, honestly. Just because of the randomness of it. Like, it's one thing if you go to an event and all week long, you know, like, the 10 guys are going to be there and you meet them. But for just the fact that I'm sitting in this dressing room, which is absurd anyway, the idea that I have a dressing room and, like, 10 Hall of Famers are basically, like, wandering around hallways, then they just come in and, like, they're sharing stories. And that was the other thing, is they're, like, chopping it up. I mean, they were laughing and cutting up and telling stories about each other and you know, doing things on one another in the room. So I'm just sitting there listening to all that, you know, watching the volleys go back and forth between these guys.
Well, and even over and above that, you started the day at 11 o'clock thinking you're, you know, having dinner and going to bed. And the next thing you know, you're in New York riding with Gary Carter in a, you know, a dressing room with 10 Hall of Famers and going to the Orioles and Yankees. I mean, it's just what a great story. I mean, that's what those are the great stories is when.
Yeah, it was. I'll never forget it.
So I don't know how to transition off of that, but I do want to move and talk to you a little bit about your move. Going from a beat writer, you got hired with 106.7, you were doing the beat for the Skins, and then you started doing the show with Danny Ruelle, as I mentioned earlier. First, I just wanted to ask you what the transition was like going from being a beat writer to being on the air, you know, 4 hours a day, 5 days a week.
The transition was not particularly difficult, just because I've been doing talk shows for a long time. A lot of people may not know locally, but I do baseball shows on XM Radio nationally, and for a long time I've been doing 2-3 baseball shows a week on XM, and I've done some other work on other channels, college sports, and done football and different shows for them. So it was something where I've done enough shows, and then obviously as a fan was doing nights and weekends at different times solo. So it wasn't like I needed to learn necessarily to host a show, but there are a lot of things about hosting a show every day the relentlessness of the grind, the fact that it's constant. You know, it's overstated to call it show business, but you know, in this show must go on sense, day in and day out, there are no days off kind of thing. It is a learning curve. There was a lot. I felt like I knew exactly what I was getting into, and I really didn't, just because I'd never done it before. I don't think you can be properly prepared until you've done 20 hours of radio a week and you're in the dog days of an off season in football, and there's nothing to talk about, and you're trying to come up with content that people, you know, A, are interested in, and B, can provoke some thought. That said, the transition, it was one that was kind of compelling to me. It's weird. I loved feet, and I, you know, a huge part of me wishes I was still on the beat. And just in the sense that there was nothing about it I didn't like. I love football very much. I've always grew up liking the Redskins and have cared about that team and just the National Football League is, for me, is king. And I'm around this team and this league with access that it's, you know, unprecedented unless you're on a beat and learning about the game. I felt like every day I learned more about football, and you're learning it from players and the coaches, and it's just really cool. So I liked the beat. I liked reporting. I liked the juice of chasing stories. I liked the pressure of getting things right and all those things. It was just a natural progression for me after 4 years to do the radio show. I mean, you could do that forever. I could be content and happy doing it forever. I could have done that for 30 years just in terms of being content with my life. But I always compare it to, like, you're in a good relationship for 4 years in your late 20s or whatever. Society says it's time to propose or get married. The natural next progression was to do a talk show. That's just how the business really works, in the sense of if you've done the beat, you know, you're ready to kind of do something else. What's next? This was the next thing. The cool thing for me was, A, the project middays is a good time slot. It really is. And as far as lifestyle goes, it's the most normal slot for hours I'll ever have in this business, because I leave my house a little bit before 8 and I'm home a little bit after, you know, 3. But also I get to work with my friends. You know, I was very close with Danny, and the fact that we got to work together was a big perk to it as well. So the transition was tough at first, just because, you know, like I said, I don't think you really prepare yourself for 4 hours every day on a week where nothing's going on. And there's times where you have to talk about stuff that you either just don't care that much about, or that you're not particularly interested in, or that you don't think it's a good topic, but you know that people would be interested to hear it. So that's kind of the hard part at first, getting used to some of that stuff. But overall, I really have enjoyed it. I love my job. I mean, I can't complain. It's not like work, I say that.
Well, and that leads in perfectly into the next question. So peel back the curtain a little bit. I mean, I think us as, you know, outsiders, we hear you from 10 to 2. But what is it really doing a show? I mean, you say you leave your house around 8 and you leave at 3. I mean, what is the prep work like? And kind of peel back the curtain a little bit on what we don't know.
I'd say the main thing is that most of the show is put together before I get to the office at 8:30 or 8, you know, around then, probably give or take a few minutes of traffic. But, you know, as an example, tomorrow's show will largely be in place by the time I wake up tomorrow, because at the end of every night, you know, I've got the games that have already happened and most of the storylines. Now, there are things that are going to change, obviously, over the course of an evening, and that's why I come tomorrow morning, you know, we sit down at 9 o'clock and have a show meeting. But generally the way it works is, you know, we have an email chain, a Google Doc type thing that every day we add to as we see a story we like or read something that's interesting to us. And then from that we'll eventually, you know, pull storylines and topics that we like, ideas of things to talk about. But just to kind of run through it, I would say, you know, at night, put together like a rough rundown. A lot of times it's going to have topics, you know, certain segments, guests, what have you. We get to the station, and by 9 o'clock, we have a meeting every day. What we want to talk about, what we like, what we don't like. By about 9:30, we try to have everything in place on a show rundown, kind of written in front of us. So you do some last minute prep type stuff. 10 o'clock, because the on-air light comes on and we do the show from 10 to 2. And obviously, the rundown is too subject to be thrown out and changed considerably. You know, it does just about every day because something breaks or something happens. And you kind of want to react because that's the whole point of the medium. It's not like TV where you kind of get a news van and cameras there or, you know, newspaper where you get to wait till the next day. I mean, we get to just start talking about it right away. So 10 to 2 is obviously kind of read and react, but you stick to the script as best as you can. And then as of 2 o'clock, normally we have another meeting just right after the show. Kind of what we liked, what we didn't like, what went well, what didn't. We talk about the next day. That's normally when we plan out what guests we want to approach for the next day. If we know the Caps are playing a playoff game, you know, maybe we'll hit up PR to see the following day if we might be able to get someone, or you know, maybe we'll decide, okay, let's get an NHL expert on. You know, talk about Ovechkin going for 50th goal or whatever. And then normally, that meeting goes about a half hour. A lot of times I'll stay at the fan and just work on a couple things for the next day for a little while after that. And then normally, like I said, by 3, you know, I'm on the road and on my way home. The one thing I would say is, it's the kind of job where you're always on in the sense that, like, if you're watching a sports show on TV and you see them doing a topic you like, or you see them, you know, having some conversation about some player that you like, you're going to jot it down and text it, or you're going to email it, you know, something like that. So you're kind of working until the next morning at that point off and on to try to put that rundown together. And then at about 10 o'clock each night, you know, you try to formulate it all and throw it all into a show.
Well, that fills in a lot of gaps, but you're really, it's kind of 24/7 in a lot of ways. That's pretty amazing. So
it is, just because you're thinking about the show a lot, you know. I would say it's not like a lot of jobs where when you leave the office, until you're back at your desk the next morning, you're done, or you're just, you know, you're not able to do the next spreadsheet, you're not able to do the next Word document, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
It's way more ubiquitous. The beat was 24/7. You know, the beat, you're a paramedic. Without being able to help people, without all of the actual cool things about being a paramedic, you're just constantly waiting for a phone call. The show is not like that, but it is still something where you're always planning, you're always thinking.
Yeah, that makes a lot of that rings true. So I know your co-host Danny he's a stand-up comic on the side and kind of a funny guy. Do you have a good Danny story you can share? Or your favorite story?
I have a lot of good Danny stories. I'm trying to think of a particularly good one. I mean, he's hilarious to work with. He cracks me up all the time. You know, a lot of times on air, a lot of times off air, obviously. I'm trying to think of something particularly good. Just very talented comedian. He's at different times, I've done shows from New York because he was auditioning for Last Comic Standing, or, you know, it's been one place or another for comedy gigs. As far as stories go, I'm trying to think. I don't think what was on the spot. Something Danny he's been or yet?
It's just a good story. Sums up Danny.
I mean, the one thing I'd say is he's like a perfectionist. And like,
is that right?
I think his toughest critic, probably, I would say. Like, he's the kind of guy that we'll do a segment, and we'll finish the segment, and I'll say, oh, that was pretty good. And he'll be kind of like kicking himself, beating himself up across the room, like, what's going on? I didn't like that segment, I was bad in that segment. He's like pacing all around the room with his like hands on top of his head. Like, he wears it, he takes it. And it's not even like he did an actual bad segment. Like, he made it so like something that he thought didn't sound right or something. I didn't like getting his head, but, just because you want to work with people that care, you want to work with people that want to be really does. He's ultra talented. You know, he knows his sports as well as anybody I know. He knows DC sports like the back of his hand. He cares a lot, and he's hilarious. You know, so
yeah, I don't think people understand how good of a baseball player he was. I mean, I played against him growing up, and he was a great player. Not a good player, yeah. A great player.
I mean, I obviously didn't see him play. But something we talk about a lot was his college baseball career, because that was such a huge part of his life. I mean, for a long time, he wanted to, play big league baseball. I mean, I think like a lot of people did, but his dream was alive a little bit longer probably than most. I mean, like you said, he was really, really good, and I think that's part of why he knows the game as well as he does. I mean, he's very, very smart when it comes to baseball, and I really like the segments we get to do on the Nationals, because I think we can talk about them in a way that most people in town just can't or don't.
Yeah, I can promise you, Danny could flat out hit a baseball. And I would love to give him a jab here, but he could flat out hit. He was a good player. So, but you brought up the Nationals, and that's kind of the next topic I wanted to bring up. I don't want to pound them. I know they're 2-6 as we're recording right now. That's not kind of where I want to take this. I mean, I'm sure you guys are going to spend 4 hours tomorrow kind of clubbing the team. But I do want to ask you a little bit, just a general, what are your short-term concerns about the team, and do you have kind of long-term concerns about the 2015 team?
I do. I mean, the short-term concerns are that their offense isn't going to be very good until they get Anthony Rendon and Bernard Spann back. Now, they shouldn't be as bad as they are. I mean, they are entering play on Wednesday, worst in Major League Baseball in batting average and on base percentage. But you can be bad, you can be a lot better than 30th out of 30. So they need to somehow find a way to scratch across more runs. Maybe that'll start as they had a 6-run inning in Boston. He definitely has been inept offensively and completely anemic at the plate. And he had a 3-hit game, so perhaps he snaps out of his slumber here. But what they need to do offensively in the meantime, without Spann as a table center, now that they've got work and they've got Anthony Rendon hopefully on the mend and back, they've got to find a way to get themselves to 3 or 4 runs a night. So they're going to win plenty of baseball games they score 4 times. The problem is, if you look at the first week of the season, they just haven't been doing that. But they need the guys that actually are every day, solid or just major leaders, to make something, to make the defense problems, give them something in the middle of the order. They've got to get more than comprised. Bryce Harper's driven the ball over the fence a couple times, but other than that, sniping out way too often, and the quality of the at-bat has not been great for him. So those guys need heavy lifting until all hands are on deck, and they haven't. That's a short-term concern for me, because I do think that will cure itself as we go along here. The longer-term concern is actually also a short-term concern. This is something I said before the season is a big bother for me, and that is I don't like their bullpen on paper very much. Losing Tyler Clifford, I think, is a massive step up. It's a good trade, in my opinion, because you got 2 years of control. So they're asking a lot from guys who have never executed the roles that they're currently being put in. If you look at Craig Stammen, higher leverage, later in these situations, probably this year than he's been in, but he's trying to, who I love, I have a man crush on, is being asked to pitch. Is had his struggles obviously in October. It's been great regular season, but he didn't have much of a spring. Have you seen already the regular season that he did today? And then enough to do it. Blevins traded all good when it was made. So to me, the bullpen is something that I think.
Grant, I'm having trouble hearing you.
Oh, you can't hear me?
Oh, there you go. There. I lost you for a minute or so. I was having trouble hearing you.
Oh, okay. Well, where did you lose it, do you know?
You were just kind of diving into the bullpen, and you were saying that on paper you didn't like it.
Okay. Yeah, so on paper, I don't love the bullpen. I'll just run through what I was saying again real quick. You lose Tyler Clifford, and you don't really replace him. They go get Casey Jansen, who's hurt, to pitch in the eighth inning. Blake Treinen's a guy that's young without much experience, and they're asking him to pitch in high-leverage situations at the end of games. While I love his stuff, I'm not sure that he's quite ready for that yet. Aaron Barrett was melting down last time we saw him in the playoffs, and now he's all of a sudden going to be a critical eighth-inning arm. You know, Storen, who's had his problems in October, has been great in the regular season, but he didn't pitch a lot in the spring and had little issues that kept him from really getting into his routine. So I think he could get off to a slow start, too. So for me, that bullpen on paper, just a lot of guys being asked to do things they really haven't before. Even guys like Craig Stammen have been around, and now he's pitching later in games, higher leverage. Tanner Roark's kind of out of position in the sense that if he's just a long man, you're not getting enough out of the value that he really provides for me. So I think they're absolutely going to have to address the bullpen at the deadline later in the season. So that's a shorter-term and a longer-term issue for me, because I really do think that they're going to need to bolster that group. And the Blevins deal didn't make any sense. I think they're going to have to pick up a lefty specialist, because the only lefty they've got is Thornton. They sent Cedeno down already, and he clearly wasn't able to give them what they needed or wanted this season probably, and they've made the decision, at least for now, to go without him. So I don't love that bullpen, but big picture, I think they're going to be fine. You know, it's a bad division. The Marlins are the only team that can really challenge them, in my opinion. And I would still bet on them to win the division handily. But those are a couple of the things that bother me about this team. Is not just going to watch them now, but even as you make some projections before the season started.
Yeah, it's funny. I liked the Blevins trade 2 weeks ago, and now it feels like with Bendecker in the minor leagues and, you know, Cedeno now in the minor leagues, it feels like, wow, that was maybe not the trade they should have made.
Well, the trade made sense to me because they needed outfield help. So just in a vacuum, you say you're trading a lefty reliever for an outfielder when you have a few injured outfielders. That makes sense, except that Bendecker's pretty much a 4A guy, in my opinion. He's going to spend more time in the minors than the majors this year. Really, if not for the injuries to Jason Worth and Denard Span, he probably wouldn't have been in the majors at all to start the year. So he trades Jerry Blevins for a triple-A player, which you could say is because Xavier Cedeno, he didn't want to option down because he needed to keep him in the big league. But then in less than a week, he sent Cedeno down. So I really don't know what the logic was on the Blevins deal necessarily, and it doesn't help the fact that he's gotten off to an amazing start in New York.
Yeah, because they're using him exactly how they should. He's faced, I think, all lefties in his entire appearances. So, well, Grant,
yeah, he's 2 2/3. He's got 4 strikeouts, and he's just been filthy against lefty bats, which is as we saw last season. Even though his career numbers show that he really was not just a lefty specialist, but he's a guy who could get both righties and lefties out, and that's what he became at one point last year. And he's just limmy, and he's tough to pick up from the left side.
Yeah, I like you say, in the vacuum, that trade made sense a couple weeks ago, but now it definitely has put a hole in the bullpen for sure. So hopefully we can resolve it. Maybe it's Matt Grace, maybe it's Rivero or somebody else in the system. So, well, Grant, I don't want to keep you too long. It is a work night, and I've already impinged on your time enough, but I do want to play a round of rapid fire, ask you a few quick questions, and kind of the first thing that comes to your mind off the top of your head.
Absolutely, I'm ready to go.
All right, first question. Coolest experience you've had due to being in the media?
Getting to cover Super Bowls, and I would say the access you get where at a game you can be on the field pregame, in the locker room after the game, and just getting to see players interact as people in the locker room or out and about.
Very cool. That I agree. That's a good one. So, favorite DC athlete of all time?
Of my time, I would go with Chris Cooley. I grew up acting like him on the backyard field. All time, I would go with either Walter Johnson, just reading up on him, or a guy like Peter Bondra.
Oh, Peter Bondra's a good name. That is a good name. Okay. Favorite person you've been fortunate enough to interview?
Cal Ripken Jr. and Michael Jordan.
Wow, I didn't know you got Jordan. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, when he was a Wizard, a very brief interview in his final season.
Wow. What was he like?
Cool, very business-oriented. He was fun, though. I mean, he laughed and smiled. Because I was younger, kind of had a little fun with me. But really cool guy.
Okay.
Control of the room.
That's cool. Next question. Most underrated place to eat in D.C.?
I will go with Hill Country Barbecue near the Verizon Center.
Oh, that's a good answer. Okay. I like that spot. I haven't been there in a while, but that is a good spot.
Amazing. Market-style barbecue, mac and cheese is a 10.
All right. There's a plug for somebody. Definitely check it out. And, Grant, in all seriousness, final question. Where is Grant Paulson in 5 years?
Amazing question. Gosh, I wish I knew the answer to that. I would say 5 years from now, I am hopefully in a broadcast booth calling games in some capacity. My goal is to play-by-play.
What sport? Or does it matter?
Football and baseball would be the two that I want to call, but I'd call anything on the way there, I guess.
Well, that sounds great. Grant, I've asked you everything that I've got. I'd love to give you a spot here for your plugs where people can find you on Twitter, where they can find you on the radio, and anything you want to plug.
Yeah, Twitter is one way certainly to follow and keep in touch with me, at Grant H. Paulson on Twitter. And listen to the show, obviously, Monday through Friday on 106.7 The Fan from 10 to 2.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of your show, and I hope to hear you on the radio more often, you know, both on Sirius XM and some more baseball stuff as well.
I appreciate that, and thank you for wanting to do this. It's cool. I enjoyed it.
And, Grant, I can't thank you enough for joining me. Big fan of your work, as I said. You know, I feel like I've grown up kind of watching you a couple years older, but big inspiration for me. I'm very pleased and honored that you carved out some time to join me on the show. So thank you, and this was a great treat for me, so thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. You bet. I'm happy to do it.
So, that was great. And that was my interview with Grant Paulson from 106.7 The Fan. I hope everybody enjoyed that as much as I did, because I know that I certainly feel like I've watched his career kind of from a pretty close view here as a D.C. resident, and it's been pretty cool to see him. And it's really nice to have a couple of baseball guys doing midday on 106.7 The Fan. And shout out to Danny Rouillet, too. A real good guy. Hope we get him on the show sometime soon. So, we are done for episode 31. Bye for now.